this works?
Yes,
I can do this. So, while Steve makes his way up here, it's a great pleasure and honor for me to introduce Professor Steve Fuller of the University of Warwick, where he holds what is called the August Comte Chair in Social Epistemology. Now, that term has a dual reference. One, of course, to August Comte, one of the greatest of European sociologists, one of the leading figures of the first generation of sociology, actually often called the father of sociology. Now, social epistemology refers to a discipline of which Steve is one of the founders. What social epistemology refers to is a very significant development in epistemology, which Steve started specifically in a book by that title, Social Epistemology, from, I think, 1988, I believe. So what's so special? What is social epistemology? Well, social epistemology makes a break with the traditional epistemology in the European tradition on a couple of crucial points. In the first place, it is social epistemology. Traditional epistemology, as you know, stands in the line of thought of Descartes. It is individualistic epistemology. The epistemological challenge is how to make sure that for each of us, locked into our own minds, the chief epistemological challenge is that to make sure that there is a world at all, that there is an objective world that we live in. Now, social epistemology takes that for granted. Of course, we live in a shared world, and the road to certain knowledge does not go via sort of deliberation on our subjective sensations to ensure that they correspond to an external world. No, the chief source of human knowledge is something shared, i.e. science. So here you have the first point on which social epistemology breaks with classical individualistic, might almost say solipsistic epistemology. The second point on which it diverges is that it is naturalistic. That means that philosophy finally abandons the idea that we can pronounce on the way to cognize the world, to get to know about the world from our armchairs, as if we can pronounce a priori on how to go about knowing the world. Epistemology in itself has to go scientific. It has to be naturalized, as the term goes. That is, if you want to know how human knowledge works, socialized knowledge, i.e. scientific knowledge, then we should use science to investigate our scientific endeavors. And that is the second chief point. Now, on the third point, social epistemology stays faithful to the tradition. It is normative. It's not only a question about analyzing human cognition. It's about improving human cognition. So this was extremely advanced stuff back in 1988. I think it's quite impressive when you read Steve's work from back then to see how during the last, or the next like 25 years or so, the rest of the epistemological community has sort of played catch up with Steve. They are sort of slowly moving toward the position that Steve announced already in the late 1980s. Now, of course, in the meantime, Steve, who is a very dynamic and prolific person, has moved on. So his more recent work is about what he calls Humanity 2.0, which is about we improve the human condition not only by improving our epistemological practices, but how we actually
Thank you.
How we actually improve upon mankind himself. We improve man, not only upon his epistemic practices, but we actually improve upon man himself. So let me just mention his most recent work, which deals in part with this. It's called Knowledge, the Philosophical Quest in History, Routledge from this year. So I look forward to hearing Steve's talk here. I followed Steve's work from the early days, and I look very much forward to hearing what he has to say to us. this afternoon. Steve, you have the floor.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Finn and Jose Antonio, for inviting me and for all of you showing up. What I've already put on the screen here is my email address if you want to contact me. This term social epistemology, which Finn provided a nice introduction to. And there's also a website that was started by one of my students a couple of years ago, which actually kind of runs a lot of blogs and reviews and things of that kind. So you can keep up with what people are thinking about concerning the wide range of areas that are covered under social epistemology. What I want to talk about today is a topic that's been a kind of constant theme throughout my career. It's a topic that Jose Antonio asked me to address, and it has to do with science and democracy. The relationship between these two things is quite diverse. And what I'd like to do in the time allotted to me is to kind of give you a sense of the different kinds of issues that have come onto my philosophical horizon as from the time I first started thinking about this. Because I think one of the things that is clear about the project of social epistemology from the way in which I first conceptualized it was, in a way, it was about the democratization of knowledge. Okay? So in other words, part of the socializing of knowledge was the democratizing of it. Because if you look at the, if you go back to this book that he referred to, the first book of mine, one of the things that I say right at the outset is that the normative question of epistemology ought to be about how do we organize our knowledge production and distribution practices given that human beings basically are finite, right? And that they're imperfect in all kinds of ways, and often the imperfections are complementary, but often there's some very much endemic ones that cut across regardless of how much education you have or whatever your background has to be. Okay, and in this respect, I would just say at the outset, one of the things that I got very much plugged into early on when I was writing social epistemology, which I think has become much more important in epistemology and philosophy of science over the past quarter century, has been the psychology of science, and in particular, the cognitive psychology of science, where now it's quite commonplace to talk about the various biases, prejudices, shortcomings of the mind, and as a result, one has to play tricks on the mind in order to get people to do things the right way. This has become a very sort of common argument to make across many different fields, not only in philosophy, but also in more applied fields as well, in management, etc. It was still quite a new thing when I was starting out in social epistemology, but that does inform kind of my view of the human being at the outset. Namely, we're talking about fallible, finite creatures. And it's on that basis, at the very outset, that one wants to talk about issues of collectivizing and organizing and so forth, right? So it was very much, from the outset, a theory of knowledge that was against any kind of great man or genius theory of knowledge, okay? And there was always the concern, I think, when one talked about more classical epistemology, even though Descartes, of course, was very upfront about the fallibility of human cognition. After all, the Cartesian demon is all about that, right? The possibility we might be radically wrong in what we think about the world. But nevertheless, I think the individualistic stance and the way in which one could think about knowledge as something that one could generalize from individuals did tend to lead to kind of an elitist notion of knowledge, basically, because one then thinks about, from a normative standpoint, what would the ideal cognizer know? And so even if you move into something like the, because the first kind of, you might say, model for this way of thinking about things was, of course, God, right? God is the ideal cognizer who knows everything in the optimal way, etc., etc. But even as we move into the modern period where God is out of the picture and we're talking about a more scientific worldview, nevertheless, you can still find, certainly in the days when I was a graduate student, and maybe there might even be some people in the room who still believe this, that in a sense, you know, the optimally rational scientific mind is someone who's able to evaluate all the evidence that's available and give it the proper weighting before making any kind of judgment, right? This kind of artificial intelligence, essentially, model of what the scientific cognizer is. This was still around when I was training in the philosophy of science. And of course, there are philosophers of science And I'll just name one, and I don't know if anyone would have heard of him, but he's an interesting guy in this context, Paul Humphreys, who is a philosopher at the University of Virginia, who's actually written a book basically saying that advanced artificial intelligences could do science better than people because people are too imperfect. And so, therefore, you need to turn it over to actually, in principle, right, machines or some kind of entities that actually have the right mental dispositions and don't suffer from the kinds of fallibilities that human beings routinely suffer from. Okay? So there's a sense in which... And by the way, you know, in mentioning all this, I think this gives you a little bit of a hint why, as the years have gone on, I've become increasingly interested in the nature of the human being in all this. Right? Because there's a sense in which, and I have to admit this to be true, that if you think about the criteria of rationality, especially scientific rationality, that we've put forward, especially in the 20th century, you know, whether we're talking about Bayes' theorem or we're talking about falsifiability from Popper or we're talking about standard logical positivist ways of doing theory testing and theory choice, the sorts of beings who would be best equipped to do this aren't us. Right? And in fact, a lot of this research in cognitive psychology that I was alluding to that talks about human biases and fallibilities and stuff like that actually arose as a result of trying to explain why it is that human beings consistently fail on every standard of scientific rationality, regardless of training. Okay? Now, I think a lot of the fundamental skepticism that people have these days about... ideas of scientific rationality generally, right? In other words, people who think that, you know, general philosophy of science. I'm not talking about the philosophy of science that deals with, you know, philosophy of the special sciences, because there's always a kind of busy work to be done there with regard to conceptual foundations and things like that, where the science basically gives you the subject matter. But what I'm talking about here is the more general philosophy of science. That is to say, the philosophy of science of the positivists, of Popper, you know, of the sort that, you know, Kuhn, Loudon, Lakatos, even the stuff, you know, the scientific realists, all these people are, you know, science with a capital S, this kind of general conception of science. Can we actually come up with any sort of theory of rationality that's appropriate for that form of knowledge? And I think that there's a lot of people, especially people who practice, empirical studies of knowledge. So I'm thinking of the historians of science, the sociologists of science, as well as the psychologists of science. All of these people will generally be quite skeptical about whether there's really anything there for a philosopher to study. Right? That this is just an illusion. Okay? Now, the more adventurous people, of course, are the artificial intelligence people who basically say it's not an illusion, it's just you were wrong to think human beings did it. Computers do it. And all the philosophy of science has always been about is a theory of the optimal computer mind. But we mistook it to be a human being. Okay? And I do think this is kind of a real kind of issue. Now, social epistemology, from that standpoint, and I think we're sort of at that standpoint today, looks kind of interesting because the promise of the social, in a way, was always, you might say, along the lines of two heads are better than one, right? In other words, that if we can come up with the right way of organizing people, right, that in some sense maybe their biases or their prejudices can cancel out, maybe they can arrange themselves in a way that actually enable them to adjudicate their differences, right? So we can figure out who's right, who's wrong, by how much, and how do we proceed from there collectively, right? That's always been the promise of the social, that in a sense you can start with the finite, imperfect human beings, but that somehow through some sort of sociological magic, right, some ideal institutional arrangement, right, some form of organization, that we can actually end up knowing, you know, that the whole, as it were, the whole of the collective of inquiry can know more than just the sum of the individual inquirers. This was always kind of the hope, right? And so the idea, you know, and if we look at the history of the philosophy of science and of thinking about science generally, right, we can start with, Francis Bacon, right, Solomon's House, The idea being, look, we're going to bring all the smart guys together in one building. We're going to set up some procedures. We understand these smart guys all have different views about the world, and a lot of them are informed by crazy ideas, but some of them might be right. And what we want to do is to figure out which one is right. And so what we want to do then is we want to have a procedure that everybody agrees to, and this is where the scientific method comes in. And the scientific method functions basically as a judicial procedure for adjudicating between differences when you know that all the parties concerned are biased. That's basically what the scientific method was designed to do. If you read Francis Bacon's Idylls of the Tribe and all this kind of stuff, that was what it was about. And so there's a long history, actually, of thinking about that the way you do science is by taking people who you understand to be quite flawed, quite fallible, but you organize them in some kind of way, okay? And this was true in the Enlightenment. It explained the rise of scientific societies. There's a lot of interesting questions about the nature of the human being that are bound up with this kind of idea. And in particular, if you believe that, as it were, two heads are better than one, and that, you know, we in some way can come out smarter by checking, in some way, mutually validating our differences, then you can imagine a kind of social epistemology that produces a kind of knowledge that individuals wouldn't be able to do. So Karl Popper, for example, who often isn't seen as a social epistemologist, but I would say is very much one, right? You know about his method of conjectures and refutations. Right, that's basically the sociological embodiment of the falsifiability principle. Because what Popper imagined was that a given scientist, given the scientist's biases, vanity, fixed ideas, whatever you want to call it, will never falsify his own hypothesis. Right, he'll just die, but somebody else will. Right, somebody else will falsify his hypothesis. And that narcissistic guy I started with will falsify the other guy's hypothesis, right? And so the idea is the bold conjectures take advantage of the fact that people are very strong-willed, very narcissistic, they really push their own ideas, but if they are interacting with other people who are of a similar mind, and as a result are motivated to knock down the other guy's ideas, then you might get a sense of what's true. Right? That was kind of Popper's idea. So you take two highly fallible, prejudiced even, individuals, and you have them interacting with each other in a free space, and you get a kind of knowledge you wouldn't be able to get from either of them individually. Okay, that's a very small kind of miniature example of how, in a sense, thinking about the organization in the right way might actually be able to cancel out a lot of the biases and prejudices that individuals have otherwise. Now the question is, how far can you go with this, right? How far can you go with this? Because is it possible? Because it's one thing to say, okay, I can imagine this kind of system working if we're talking about people who already have PhDs, right? There's certainly a lot of narcissistic, vain PhD-carrying scientists who have all kinds of fixed ideas, and maybe if you put them in the Popperian room, they would be able to do something like Popper expects. But can we do that for everybody? Right? I mean, could everyone actually be involved in a process like this? Could everyone actually be involved in a process of checking and testing and validating theories? Because this is the democracy question, right? The democracy question, in a way, the first step you get to democracy is to start by saying, look, human beings are fallible. Human beings are imperfect. You're never going to get a perfect cognizer. So in a sense, you're always going to have to rely more than just one person. Okay? Now the question is, can you rely on everyone? Okay? Because the democracy question forces it out this way. And here's where you start to get some interesting kinds of issues with regard to institutional boundaries. Okay? And my own social epistemology has been working on developing this idea, and there are a lot of angles on it, but let me just lay out a few of them because they are worth thinking about. One of the things about science, and one of the things you might say, because you might ask, what is it about science that pushes us in a direction toward democracy? What is it about science that does it? And the answer I would say is that science pretends, or claims to be, or is taken to be, universal knowledge. Okay? So it's the universality of science that is, in a sense, pushing the democratic move. Right? In other words, if science, and this is where I think, you know, we need to take on board, and I don't know if some of you do know about my work, as you know, some people sometimes think I'm a relativist or something, which I'm not. And here's a great example of showing how I'm not, because I actually think we need to take this idea of universalism, universal truth, seriously, as a claim that science is making, as a distinctive form of knowledge. Okay? Which is to say that if we're going to claim that Newton's laws apply to everybody, okay, then you might say, well, this is a law that, you know, this is much more important than the laws of my land. This is a law that, in a sense, comes from God, you might say, and applies to everyone equally, right? So in a way, its application is very democratic, so why shouldn't our knowledge of it be democratic? Okay? And I do think that's not by any means some sort of, deductive proof or anything, but it does give you a sense of where the intuition's coming from, right? Because if we were just talking about forms of knowledge that only work in certain specified settings, plumbing, right? Fixing your sink at home, plumbing is a kind of knowledge, right? It's not universal knowledge, it is knowledge about plumbing. When you have a problem with plumbing, you need knowledge of plumbing, whether you have it or the plumber has it. But plumbing is not universal knowledge. It doesn't make that kind of claim. Plumber is not a guy you would call the smartest man in the world. But he's very smart if you have a leak in your sink. Okay? And that's a different kind of knowledge. But science aims to be universal knowledge. And so then there's a different sort of... So there's a sense in which I would say, and this is where I differ with a lot of people who call themselves social epistemologists, because I'm not the only one. There are all these guys in analytic philosophy who do it. But where I differ is that I think that the idea of expertise is not something to rejoice in, but to find problematic. Especially if we're talking about science, okay? In other words, if we're talking about something called science and something that has that kind of scientific validity to it, expertise is at best a kind of temporary thing. In other words, it may be the case that there are certain forms of knowledge that are very difficult to understand because of the way they have been expressed and the way they've been developed and the fact that very few people are ever taught about them. And there are all of these contingent sociological facts about the nature of that knowledge. But if it's knowledge that's truly science and applies to everything equally, then in principle everyone should be able to have access to it. And that may end up just being a failure of pedagogy. Right? That just may be a fact that people aren't being, or that there's a sense in which people haven't figured out the right medium through which to convey the knowledge. And here, I'm a perfect believer in the way in which technology may be able to enhance us in increasing our epistemic capabilities beyond what can only be found in the unenhanced body. Okay? That point that I've just made brings us into an issue that's been of concern to me in recent years, humanity 2.0, and the issue of transhumanism and enhanced human beings and what that might mean. But I take it that part of what that movement is about, right, is in a sense, that's a kind of democratizing too, especially with regard to these issues of expertise, where it might actually become much easier for people to access forms of knowledge that in the past were just in the hands of experts, that was just esoteric, that justified a kind of hierarchical division of labor with regard to knowledge, that may in fact be in the process of disappearing, okay? Of course, I mean, I think the great way to exemplify this for better or worse, and I put this on the table because I think this is in a way, it has its problems, is of course the internet. The fact that people no longer need to trust experts, right? That in a sense, the internet tells you immediately who the expert is, but also all the counter experts you can be looking at as well. You got it all right there, and it forces you effectively to make a decision for yourself. In other words, one of the things that I consider to be a great virtue of the internet with regard to the democratization of knowledge is that it opens up a decision space for you with regard to knowledge that previously did not exist, at least not in respectable company. Okay? Now people take for granted that if they want to find out something, they'll go to the internet and they'll see several different accounts and they'll be forced to make a decision about them. Who's right, who's wrong, to what degree, etc. That is a relatively new thing, and that is something that is being valorized in practice. If you go back to a lot of the social epistemology that existed when I was in, you know, when I started the field, and you know, even going into the present day, there is this enormous veneration for expertise. And that so much of that kind of social epistemology is simply just trying to figure out who should I trust. Like, trust becomes the issue. The sign of a democracy is when you don't have to worry about trust. You just make the decision yourself, right? And you inform yourself. You don't go around trusting. You make the decision and through an informed public. And then the issue becomes, and this is where we go back to the organization of knowledge again. Then the issue becomes, how is it that you organize all of these different people making all these different decisions on the basis of course, what will be different knowledge bases? Because people will, let's say everybody's relying on the internet, they will be accessing it differently, they will be drawing different conclusions from what they're accessing. And so then the interesting sociological question is, how do you combine and organize all of those opinions to come up with some sort of form of collective action, not only in the sense of representing what people want, but also in the sense of holding people accountable for the consequences of what they want? Because that's the other side of the question that I think is very often neglected when people talk about social epistemology. The issue isn't going to be a matter of how do we organize people so we can maximize people's doing the right thing. You know, it's as if we already know the truth, and somehow we have to come up with a social model that matches up to it. No, that's not the world we live in, right? We live in a world where what you want to do is to organize people who are increasingly informed, but in different ways, right? You want to be able to reach a certain kind of collective decision, but then you want that decision to be accountable in the sense that when to be able to get feedback, and especially when there are errors made, when there are problems that arise, that then enable some kind of change to be made to the pattern of behavior. Okay? In other words, what are the basic, you know, I mean, you know, if you, those of you who are old enough will know, you know, cybernetics, right? And feedback loops. This is what really we're talking about here. Right? Because I think the key thing that's very important for the kind of world that we live in now, there are two things, and I think these are two things that to a large extent classical philosophy didn't really deal with very effectively with regard to theory of knowledge, but also I think a lot of the more mainstream epistemologists and philosophers of science don't deal with well. And one of them is that we are entering, first of all, into a world where people are becoming more informed. But they're becoming more informed not in the sense that I think philosophers have traditionally imagined that idea, which is that being more informed means that more people know what the elites know. Right? That is typically what a philosopher more or less means when he says more informed, right? That more people know about what the elites already know, and that's more informed. Okay? This is the kind of theory that you often find, you know, I work in science communication in part, and in science communication, you have this kind of view that the more people learn about science, the more they'll like it. No, the more they'll just find different reasons to object to it. Right? So this is one thing. The fact is that people are becoming more informed, but that greater information is not giving us a consensus by itself. Right? So in other words, the expansion of the availability of knowledge is not leading to consensus itself. That's the first point. The second point, of course, has to do with the way in which technology, new technologies, are entering into the life world with incredible speed. Okay? And whether we're talking about biotechnology or information technology, and these are, as it were, opening up new spheres of reality, you might say. Okay, especially if we think in terms of not only the sort of genetic enhancements that might be possible biologically, but also if we talk about virtual reality, augmented reality, all of these kinds of things on the horizon, right? We're opening up new worlds in a way. And one of the consequences of opening up new worlds is, of course, they haven't been pre-theorized. So there's enormous spheres of uncertainty that are opening up, where it is very difficult to actually come up with models from the past to understand them. Okay? And what this means, of course, is that as we move into this new world, and we're already doing it, it's just to what extent are we doing it knowingly, we are opening ourselves to more risk. Right? In a sense, as we move forward, as we incorporate these innovations, we're just opening ourselves up to new risk. And so then the question becomes, how do we manage these things? Okay? And I think that there is, and here I want to make an allusion to you, Jose Antonio. You may know he published a letter in Science, the latest issue of Science magazine. Do you know about this? He's published this letter, right? Am I correct? Yes? Yeah, I keep up with you. Yes, Science magazine, the September 4th issue, there's a letter that's signed by him and several other notable people in science and technology studies across the world, actually, basically calling for a sort of moratorium on the very pro-AI kind of propaganda that one is seeing a lot, including on the pages of Science magazine, which is why you address the letter there. Okay? In other words, you know, artificial intelligence is opening up this great world, it's going to expand our horizons, all this wonderful stuff. And what this letter says is basically that, well, actually, very few people are actually involved in promoting this. Right? So the people in Silicon Valley and other kinds of places who are promoting this big AI future, which then, you know, has these kinds of downstream effects in terms of the additional apps that you put on your smartphones, okay, they represent a relatively small percentage of the population. They are sort of, in a way, unelected governors, because nobody actually asked them to take this great lead in defining what the future should be. They've just taken it upon themselves to do it because they have a lot of money and some products to sell, okay? And so what this letter calls for is for the scientific establishment, which is what Science magazine represents. Science magazine is not a commercial organ of anyone, okay? It is the magazine of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. That it should stop this kind of free publicity. And what instead we should have are some serious thinking about bringing more voices, different points of view, looking at different ways in which this kind of revolution that is admittedly taking place in artificial intelligence will impact the, you know, ordinary people's lives. That we actually need that. And until we are actually able to facilitate this kind of democratic arrangement, we should have a moratorium on AI research. This is the interesting part, okay? Now, so here's the punchline of this letter, right? Where they really go for the jugular here, is they say we should actually put a halt to this research until we have figured out ways of adequately governing it. Because at the moment, even though it hasn't yet done any damage that we can hold it accountable to, it is nevertheless what used to be called in the old days runaway technology. Okay? Now that's pretty interesting, right? And I have to say, I don't fully agree with it. but I do think this is exactly the kind of issue that in a way needs to be on the table, right? Where, you know, as it were, it's the new look, you might say the new look of how democracy and science will operate, right? Because it will be playing a kind of catch-up, right? In other words, the way in which the world is developing, not only are people getting more access to more information from more places, but there are also more innovations coming on stream, right, which few people, let alone governments, are in any position to stop or halt or even curtail. So these things are just coming at us all the time. And then the question becomes, and so the democracy question then becomes, how do you respond? So in a sense, this is the interesting issue, the interesting point about the way this issue is being framed now, and I don't know how we can actually change this part of the problem, is that democracy is put on the back foot. Democracy is in response mode. And this is, I think, a function of the fact that we have a relatively unregulated free market for these new innovations. So the market just moves and moves and moves, and then government or the state or people have to somehow resist or push back or organize or channel or whatever. Now, I am not as confident as Jose Antonio and his colleagues are that we can actually halt the progress of this stuff. I actually think that would take quite a lot to do, technically speaking, and at most you'd be able to do it only in the countries you're least worried about. Right? So you're not going to do that in China. You might do it in Denmark. Right? Right? So the point is, if you want to talk about this business that we have to have a moratorium in the development of all these new technologies until we figure out a way of properly governing them from a democratic standpoint, the only places they're likely to work are the places that are probably not going to cause you any problems anyway. Okay? And that's a real, and I think there's just no way around that. So while I appreciate the sentiment of the letter, I'm not sure it's workable. So what do we do? Well, this is where I mentioned the business about the feedback loops. And let me just look at the time here. I'm going to end on this point, which means I'm not going to talk about Latour. I hope you don't mind. Because I think this is kind of more the way to go with regard to democratic governance, with regard to the new innovations. I think what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to stress issues of accountability. That is to say, we need to have mechanisms, not that stop the stuff from being developed, but we need mechanisms to monitor the consequences of it. To monitor, exactly who gets access to these technologies. How are they being used? What are the downstream effects? How does it affect people's personal lives? How does it affect the labor market? Right? How does it affect the environment? Right? In other words, we need a downstream accountability. And that is the thing at the moment that I think is lacking, that at the same time, I think can be done something about politically. Okay? Is to get accountability after the fact. In other words, if things do go wrong, okay, as they probably will at some point about some of these things, whether we're talking about biotech or infotech, something bad is bound to happen. Small bad things are already happening, okay? That we actually have ways of detecting them earlier, and we also have ways of bringing people to account as a result of those errors and being able to learn from those errors as a result. Because I do believe that with information technology and biotechnology, we are in its kind of infant stage preparing the infrastructure for the way in which human beings are going to live for a very long time. I have no doubt about that, okay? And because we're at the infant stage, there's bound to be a lot of mistakes made, and there's bound to be a lot of damage done. And there needs to be accountability so that we can learn from the mistakes, and also that the people who are damaged or harmed are given due process and are compensated for and are in some way recognized. And that's kind of where I would go, and that's where I would put the democratic accountability. The democratic accountability would be after the fact of the introduction. It wouldn't be at the level of deciding whether we want to do X or Y. Because I think, frankly, unless you get rid of the capitalism, that's just going to happen anyway. Okay? But what you can do is to do something about the consequences of it, and so that we can actually learn the most from it collectively. Okay, so that's where I would put the democratic accountability and democratic governance with regard to these radically new technologies. And moreover, I think epistemologically, this is a good idea because these technologies are so innovative and there are so few, if any, precedents for them, the only way we're going to know what their effects are by trying them out, are by doing them. And very often the laboratory is not sufficient. Okay, that you actually have to have the stuff out there. And that means you have to open yourself to risk. But you also have to be able to manage the risk, especially when things go wrong. And that's kind of what I'm arguing for as far as democratic governance is concerned. So my take on this issue is somewhat different from Jose Antonio's. And I think I will stop here because I think there are a lot of issues that people here might want to talk about, given I only wanted to speak for 40 minutes. And so thank you for your attention.
Okay, is this talking about technology? Is this very advanced technology? Is it working? Okay, good. Okay, so actually, let me see. I tried to write down a few keywords. One of them is actually the difference between science in the abstract and technology. And you sort of in an interesting way, I mean, it says something about this topic, sort of drifted from talking about science to begin with to technology. But I have that sort of in the back of my mind, I'll start at a slightly different place. We are talking about the democratization of science. Now, here's another sort of ambiguity, what you talked about, and one easily slides from one to the other. One is about the democratization of the production of science, and the other is democratization of the consumption of science, as it were. Obviously, with new technology, the consumption of science is extremely democratic. I mean, I can download any kind of information. I'm sure if Steve is pleased with this talk, he'll download that. He'll put this on his homepage, and you can download it. So, I mean, fresh from the horse's mouth, right? This talk will be available. So, that, I mean, here is something that's undeniable, that access to scientific facts has become democratized. So what's interesting, I think, is, I'll return to that, though, because there are problems there, but what is evidently much more problematic is the democratization of the production of science. And here, I certainly share all of Steve's worries about that. I mean, in the purely political sphere, we have more or less recognized in countries that are democratic at all. And fortunately, a lot of countries in the world are not that democratic at all, but even in the most democratic of countries, like little Denmark, we have representative government. There's no such thing as a direct democracy anymore anywhere in the world. I think not even in Iceland, where they could actually, the population of 300,000 people could also almost fit into this old place, the Althing, where their Viking forefathers actually used to decide things 1,000 years ago. So I mean, we have more or less accepted in the general social sphere that we are stuck with a representative democracy. And I think that is, we have stuck with that too in the sphere of science, i.e. with decisions in society about where we want to put our research money, right? I think I have little hopes for any kind of more direct democracy. Okay, there is a lot of work going on in social epistemology. A prominent name is Harry Collins in England, who sort of wants to expand the notion of scientific expertise to include people who do not have all the proper degrees, but do have a lot of experience. But I don't believe much in this idea of sort of people gathering together to decide, lay people gathering together to decide which way science should go, let alone sort of putting their hands into the workshop of science and sort of fitting directly with it. I think what we need to, what we should promote, I mean, what is realistic is to have much more concern in the political process upon the consequences of scientific results, right? Much more awareness of the potential effects of taking science in this or the other direction, and also for politicians to pay more attention to what scientists say. I mean, a very good example here on which perhaps Steve and I would disagree would be climate change, right? I think we have a very interesting situation here where there's great unanimity among scientists that we do face a problem, right? But there is global warming, but where politicians so far, I think, have been very successful in playing on the population's general disinterest in this issue. Disinterest is too weak, because that's sort of an active disinterest. We don't want to hear about it. We want to go on consuming, thank you very much, so we don't want to hear about it. I mean, sort of, so this is what we should work on, right, within the framework of the representational democracy. Please, politicians, show more awareness of where science is going, what scientists say, and please also exercise more management with respect to where science is going. Just do not leave it to the scientists alone, but feel free, and please do, on our behalf, the general population, do please direct scientists towards areas that are useful to society, right? So in that respect, exercise more democratic control of science, but as far as I can see, the only way this can work is within the framework of a representational democracy. Okay, but so now comes this interesting shift in the way things are changing and the way that a lot of people in social epistemology are looking at this, because here's this change from talking about abstract theories to talking about technology, right? You can see, here's a significant shift that's been going on for at least one generation, that basic science, the kind of stuff where you try to decide what are the ultimate building blocks of nature, right? Quarks or superstrings or whatever. As we all know, has been happening a great shift of funding away from that and towards technology, right? And that opens new possibilities, because when it comes to technology, we all actually have a say in the matter, because we can just decide not to use a particular technology. I mean, if I'm concerned about the troubles you might have with a computer, I can just do the way I do, because that's what people in my generation do. Paper, this has worked fine for 2,000 years. So I mean, in the situation we are today, where science is to a large, research is to a large extent about technology, we all have a sort of privileged, direct say in the matter, because we can just say, hey, I don't want to do this technology, right? I don't want to, I mean, genetically modified food products are fine, it's just that I don't trust them, so I don't want to buy them. So I have a say in the matter, not in the matter of telling the people who do this genetic modification that the science, your science is hocus pocus. It's just I'm saying I'm not buying that kind of products. And of course, this is where Mr. Latour, another prominent social epistemologist, if we want to call him that, comes in, because Latour would say, well, there's no reason to be scared of technology, because we all contribute to technology. And Mr. Latour will identify science with technology. To him, they are all one and the same. They are technoscience, right? That's technology. So to Latour, this is the problem that worries some people, worries Steve, worries me, worries you, is not really a problem. Because we all have a say in the matter with respect to technology, because we can just say, in a sense that we cannot say about abstract science, I kind of say, hey, I don't want the theory of gravity to apply to me, please, right? Or I do not want to consider my body to be constituted by quarks, right? I can't say that, but I can say, again, I won't use electronic gadgets, I won't eat genetically modified foods, and so on. I don't want to improve on my health by taking this kind of drugs, right? So according to Latour, this problem doesn't really arise because Today, science is technology, and technology is something that's all, it's up to each one of us to decide whether we want to buy into it at all. So I'm just mentioning this because this is, I mean, this is a very influential way of looking at this, right? It's to say, hey, when we worry about the democratic status of science, we are adopting a far too traditional view of science. We see science as sort of abstract theories that have a range of application. And we are looking, whereas today, science is technology, right, that we can decide to pick up, or we can decide to leave it alone, right? And democracy is, again, the view of democracy is far too traditional here. Today, democracy is the freedom of being able to buy a product or leaving it alone, right? And here you sort of, if you are as old as I am, this will give sort of you, this will remind you of something that Milton Friedman said in a book back to, I think, 1950, where it's called Freedom and Capitalism, where he says, the free market system is a perfect democratic system. I can decide anything. I can decide to buy this product. I can decide not to. Sort of. So it's just to sketch out to you the sort of the different takes that you can take on this issue. Right. I do not buy the Friedman or Latour story about technology and or freedom to choose or not to choose technology. That's sort of substituting for democracy. I believe that, I think also, as Steve has indicated, in a sort of more traditional political solution to that. But I don't believe in direct democratic intervention in the way that we handle technology. I believe in a sort of, this sort of slightly old-fashioned notion of representative democracy, where we ask our politicians, hey, please pay more attention. Do not just tell us the story about the inevitability of technological development and so on. We don't give us that rhetoric. Step back from technology, think about its consequences, and then put it out to democratic decision whether we want the kind of research that would produce that. For instance, genetic engineering or whatever. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the wonderful presentation, Steve. Thank you very much also for your suggesting and insightful comment on Steve's presentation. It is already a little bit late. This is not a laboratory, it's not a human intelligence. It's a little bit late. But still, it's not possible to give an opportunity for at least a couple of questions. So, if anybody, hay alguien que quiera plantear una cuestión, sobre todo los estudiantes del doctorado y de grado, les animo. No tenemos mucho tiempo, les he dicho, es muy tarde y tenemos que cambiar de conferenciante, pero no queremos dejar pasar la oportunidad de que haya al menos un par de preguntas que se planteen en inglés o en español a los conferenciantes. Si se plantea en español, aquí no vería más. Ok,
I'm going to ask you in English. I like it very much. But I have a concern. You were talking about the idea of monitorize the consequences of the technological decisions. And who is going to do that? Because if we don't rely on scientists, because we know that scientists have those bias, I don't rely either on politicians. And what I have to rely on citizens, because of course they can bias too. So who is going to analyze the consequences?
Well, I have to say that if you put the concern at that level, then I think you're basically, this is just strikes me as just a new way of expressing classical misgivings about democracy generally. Okay? I mean, this is what people have been saying from the time of the ancient Greeks, you know, who guards the guardians, this kind of thing. I mean, I think the thing that there is a point at which you have to either have to accept the value of there being some kind of human oversight or not, and I accept that at the outset. The question is how to do it. I think one of the things that the new information technology does allow is, in principle, many more different levels of accountability in terms of how people are able to access systems, how they're able to respond to systems. So in terms of the ability to gather data that gives you a sense of, let's say, the consequences of new technology being introduced, I think we're in the best position we've ever been in now. And that's why there is such a big boom in this so-called big data business, of trying to figure out what are the most effective ways of analyzing all this data that we're end up going to get and are already getting. But I think the questions of who you trust end up just basically boiling down to the kinds of issues that the founders of the U.S. Constitution talk about, the checks and balances, right? The ways in which there are different ways of counterbalancing. So if one group of people make one kind of decision, there is a way of checking whether that decision makes any sense, and it can in some sense be overruled or revised as a result. And I think that's going to be the best that we're ever going to have in a democracy, is a kind of countervailing system, right, where people are kind of motivated to keep the other guy honest. That's kind of what I think, and because I think that's kind of the way the kinds of democracies that have survived, you know, and this goes to the point, you know, Finn was raised, you know, saying, I don't trust a direct democracy, I don't think it can work. Well, that's true. Most democratic theorists would agree with him, right? But as a result, you then get this fairly complex system of checks and balances in place where people are able to monitor each other's judgments and to be able to call out people when they're, you know, doing something wrong. And I think that's why you need systems of accountability in place. That's the, for me, that's the key issue about democracy, is accountability more than representation, right? In a sense, it doesn't matter how many people are actually making the decision, as long as there's a way to stop a bad decision once it's been made, right? And so in this respect, I'm very much in the line with Popper and people like that, that the value, that the thing you always want in your political system to keep it, quote, democratic in the good sense, rather than just making a kind of mob rule, okay, is you want reversibility of decisions. In other words, that you can check and say, look, this decision was wrong, we need to change course of action.
On the case already, there is quite a lot of emphasis on the relevance of the notion of truth, of trust, for proper functioning of society. For instance, in the research on risk perception, the emphasis on trust is very common. Trust is a crucial social value, political value, etc. There are also some trust-inspired notions, in my view, as for instance that which is now in fashion in the European Union, of responsible innovation.
Yes.
Somehow it's a kind of family kind, no? With the notion of trust. But it's also my view that this discourse centered on trust is the contrary, the opposite of to another discourse, which is centered on accountability.
Yes.
Participation.
Yes.
So don't you think that...
I agree.
The survival of trust notion and the centering of the discourse on trust is not somehow created, occupying the space for a more democratically healthy discourse centered on accountability.
Yes, no.
Do you think that trust is always good?
No, I think usually it's bad. I mean, no, in fact, I actually think that you have put your finger right on what trust is masking, right? Trust is masking coming to terms with the mechanisms of accountability that are really required, okay? And what the only thing you ever get out of a trust discourse eventually is hierarchy, right? You give this person authority to decide this on your behalf because you trust them. You don't take responsibility yourself. You don't monitor what they do, you just delegate it to them. Okay? And so the issue of accountability just gets off the table. And you're absolutely right. When you get rid of accountability, you basically have gotten rid of the soul of democracy. Right? And you're living in a kind of authoritarian regime, a kind of soft authoritarianism, which is what I think the trust discourse promotes. So yes, that's my view.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.